Chapter 22. Ladies and gentlemen, a common cause must be made in such a design as that which brings us together this night. For without it, nothing can be done, but with it, everything. It is a common cause of right, God knows. For it is idle to suppose that the advantages of such an institution as the Glasgow Athenaeum will stop within its own walls, or be confined to its own members. Through all the society of this great and important city, upwards to the highest, and downwards to the lowest, it must, I know, be felt for good. Downward in a clear perception of, and sympathy with, those social miseries which can be alleviated, and those wide open doors to vice and crime that can be shut and barred, and upward in a greater intelligence, increased efficiency, and higher knowledge, of all who partake of its benefits themselves, or who communicate, as all must do, in a greater or less degree, some portion to the circle of relatives or friends in which they move. Nor, ladies and gentlemen, would I say for any man, however high his social position, or however great his attainments, that he might not find something to be learned even from immediate contact with such institutions. If he only saw the goddess knowledge coming out of her secluded palaces and high places to mingle with the throng, and to give them shining glimpses of the delights which were long kept hoarded up, he might learn something. If he only saw the energy and the courage with which those who earn their daily bread by the labor of their hands or heads, come night after night, as to a recreation, to that which was, perhaps, the whole absorbing business of his youth, there might still be something very wholesome for him to learn. But when he could see in such places their genial and reviving influences, their substituting of the contemplation of the beauties of nature and art, and of the wisdom of great men, for mere sensual enjoyment or stupid idleness at any rate, he would learn this, that it is at once the duty, and the interest of all good members of society, to encourage and protect them. I took occasion to say at an Athenaeum in Yorkshire a few weeks since, and I think it a point most important to be borne in mind on such commemorations as these, that when such societies are objected to, or are decried on the ground, that in the views of the objectors, education among the people has not succeeded, the term education is used with not the least reference to its real meaning, and is wholly misunderstood. Mere reading and writing is not education. It would be quite as reasonable to call bricks and mortar architecture, oils and colors art, reeds and catgut music, or the child's spelling books the works of Shakespeare, Milton, or Bacon, as to call the lowest rudiments of education, education, and to visit on that most abused and slandered word their failure in any instance. And precisely because they were not education, because, generally speaking, the word has been understood in that sense a great deal too long, because education for the business of life, and for the due cultivation of domestic virtues, is at least as important from day to day to the grown person as to the child, because real education, in the strife and contention for a livelihood, and the consequent necessity incumbent on a great number of young persons, to go into the world, when they are very young, is extremely difficult. It is because of these things, that I look upon mechanics institutions, and Athenaeums as vitally important to the well-being of society. It is because the rudiments of education may there be turned to good account in the acquisition of sound principles, and of the great virtues, hope, faith, and charity, to which all our knowledge tends. It is because of that, I take it, that you have met in education's name tonight. It is a great satisfaction to me to occupy the place I do in behalf of an infant institution, a remarkably fine child enough, of a vigorous constitution, but an infant still. I esteem myself singularly fortunate in knowing it before its prime, in the hope that I may have the pleasure of remembering in its prime, and when it has attained to its lusty maturity, that I was a friend of its youth. It has already passed through some of the disorders to which children are liable. It succeeded to an elder brother of a very meritorious character, but of rather a weak Constitution, and which expired when about 12 months old, from, it is said, a destructive habit of getting up early in the morning. It succeeded this elder brother, and has fought manfully through a sea of troubles. Its friends have often been much concerned for it. Its pulse has been exceedingly low, being only 1250, when it was expected to have been 10,000. Several relations and friends have even gone so far as to walk off once or twice in the melancholy belief that it was dead. Through all that, assisted by the indomitable energy of one or two nurses, to whom it can never be sufficiently grateful, it came triumphantly, and now, of all the youthful members of its family I ever saw, it has the strongest attitude, the healthiest look, the brightest and most cheerful air. I find the institution nobly lodged. I find it with a reading room, a coffee room, and a news room. I find it with lectures given and in progress, in sound, useful and well-selected subjects. I find it with morning and evening classes for mathematics, logic, grammar, music, French, German, Spanish, and Italian, attended by upwards of 500 persons. But, best and first of all, and what is to me more satisfactory than anything else in the history of the institution, I find that all this has been mainly achieved by the young men of Glasgow themselves, with very little assistance. And, ladies and gentlemen, as the axiom, heaven helps those who help themselves, is truer in no case than it is in this, I look to the young men of Glasgow, from such a past and such a present, to a noble future. Everything that has been done in any other Athenaeum, I confidently expect to see done here, and when that shall be the case, and when there shall be great cheap schools in connection with the institution, and when it has bound together forever all its friends, and brought over to itself all those who look upon it as an objectionable institution, then, and not till then, I hope the young men of Glasgow will rest from their labors, and think their study done. If the young men of Glasgow want any stimulus or encouragement in this wise, they have one beside them in the presence of their fair townswomen, which is irresistible. It is a most delightful circumstance to me, and one fraught with inestimable benefits to institutions of this kind, that at a meeting of this nature those who in all things are our best examples, encouragers, and friends, are not excluded. The abstract idea of the graces was in ancient times associated with those arts which refine the human understanding, and it is pleasant to see now, in the rolling of the world, the graces popularizing the practice of those arts by their example, and adorning it with their presence. I am happy to know that in the Glasgow Athenaeum there is a peculiar bond of union between the institution and the fairest part of creation. I understand that the necessary addition to the small library of books being difficult and expensive to make, the ladies have generally resolved to hold a fancy bazaar, and to devote the proceeds to this admirable purpose, and I learn with no less pleasure that Her Majesty the Queen, in a graceful and womanly sense of the excellence of this design, has consented that the bazaar shall be held under her royal patronage. I can only say, that if you do not find something very noble in your books after this, you are much duller students than I take you to be. The ladies, the single ladies, at least however disinterested I know they are by sex and nature, will, I hope, resolve to have some of the advantages of these books, by never marrying any, but members of the Athenaeum. It seems to me, it ought to be the pleasantest library in the world. Hazlitt says, in speaking of some of the graceful fancies of some familiar writer of fiction, how long since I first became acquainted with these characters, what old-fashioned friends they seem, and yet I am not tired of them like so many other friends, nor they of me. In this case the books will not only possess all the attractions of their own friendships and charms, but also the manifold, I may say womanfold, associations connected with their donors. I can imagine how, in fact, from these fanciful associations, some fair Glasgow widow may be taken for the remoter one whom Sir Roger de Coverley could not forget. I can imagine how Sophia's muff may be seen and loved, but not by Tom Jones, going down the high street on any winter day, or I can imagine the student finding in every fair form the exact counterpart of the Glasgow Athenaeum, and taking into consideration the history of Europe without the consent of Sheriff Allison. I can imagine, in short, how through all the facts and fictions of this library, these ladies will be always active, and that age will not wither them, nor custom stale their infinite variety. It seems to me to be a moral, delightful, and happy chance that this meeting has been held at this genial season of the year, when a new time is, as it were, opening before us, and when we celebrate the birth of that divine and blessed teacher, who took the highest knowledge into the humblest places, and whose great system comprehended all mankind. I hail it as a most auspicious omen, at this time of the year, when many scattered friends and families are reassembled, for the members of this institution, to be calling men together from all quarters, with a brotherly view to the general good, and a view to the general improvement, as I consider that such designs are practically worthy of the faith we hold, and a practical remembrance of the words, on earth peace, and goodwill toward men. I hope that every year which dawns on your institution will find it richer in its means of usefulness, and greater headed in the honor and respect it has gained. It can hardly speak for itself more appropriately than in the words of an English writer, when contemplating the English emblem of this period of the year, the holly tree. Mr. Dickens concluded by quoting the last three stanzas of Southey's poem, The Holly Tree. In acknowledging a vote of thanks proposed by Sir Archibald then Mr. Allison, Mr. Dickens said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I am no stranger, and I say it with the deepest gratitude to the warmth of Scottish hearts, but the warmth of your present welcome almost deprives me of any hope of acknowledging it. I will not detain you any longer at this late hour. Let it suffice to assure you, that for taking the part with which I have been honored in this festival, I have been repaid a thousandfold by your abundant kindness, and by the unspeakable gratification it has afforded me. I hope that, before many years are past, we may have another meeting in public, when we shall rejoice at the immense progress your institution will have made in the meantime, and look back upon this night with new pleasure and satisfaction. I shall now, in conclusion, repeat most heartily and fervently the quotation of Dr. Ewing, the late provost of Glasgow, which Bailey Nicol Jarvie, himself a Glasgow body, observed was elegantly putten round the town's arms. Speech. London, April 14, 1851. The sixth annual dinner of the General Theatrical Fund was held at the London Tavern on the above date. Mr. Charles Dickens occupied the chair, and in giving the toast of the evening said, "I have so often had the satisfaction of bearing my testimony, in this place, to the usefulness of the excellent institution in whose behalf we are assembled, that I should be really sensible of the disadvantage of having now nothing to say in proposing the toast you all anticipate, if I were not well assured that there is really nothing which needs be said. I have to appeal to you on the old grounds, and no ingenuity of mine could render those grounds of greater weight than they have hitherto successfully proved to you. Although the General Theatrical Fund Association, unlike many other public societies and endowments, is represented by no building, whether of stone, or brick, or glass, like that astonishing evidence of the skill and energy of my friend Mr. Paxton, which all the world is now called upon to admire, and the great merit of which, as you learn from the best authorities, is that it ought to have fallen down long before it was built, and yet that it would by no means consent to doing so, although, I say, this association possesses no architectural home, it is nevertheless as plain a fact, rests on as solid a foundation, and carries as erect a front as any building in the world. And the best and the utmost that its exponent and its advocate can do, standing here, is to point it out to those who gather round it, and to say, judge for yourselves. It may not, however, be improper for me to suggest to that portion of the company whose previous acquaintance with it may have been limited, what it is not. It is not a theatrical association whose benefits are confined to a small and exclusive body of actors. It is a society whose claims are always preferred in the name of the whole histrionic art. It is not a theatrical association adapted to a state of theatrical things entirely past and gone, and no more suited to present theatrical requirements than a string of pack horses would be suited to the conveyance of traffic between London and Birmingham. It is not a rich old gentleman, with the gout in his vitals, brushed and got up once a year, to look as vigorous as possible, and brought out for a public airing by the few survivors of a large family of nephews and nieces, who afterwards double lock the street door upon the poor relations. It is not a theatrical association which insists that no actor can share its bounty who has not walked so many years on those boards, where the English tongue is never heard between the little bars of music in an aviary of singing birds, to which the unwieldy swan of Avon is never admitted, that bounty which was gathered in the name, and for the elevation of an all-embracing art. No, if there be such things, this thing is not of that kind. This is a theatrical association, expressly adapted to the wants, and to the means of the whole theatrical profession all over England. It is a society in which the word exclusiveness is wholly unknown. It is a society which includes every actor, whether he be Benedict or Hamlet, or the ghost, or the bandit, or the court physician, or, in the one person, the whole king's army. He may do the light business, or the heavy, or the comic, or the eccentric. He may be the captain who courts the young lady, whose uncle still unaccountably persists in dressing himself in a costume 100 years older than his time. Or he may be the young lady's brother in the white gloves and inexpressibles, whose duty in the family appears to be, to listen to the female members of it whenever they sing, and to shake hands with everybody between all the verses. Or he may be the baron who gives the fete, and who sits uneasily on the sofa under a canopy with the baroness, while the fete is going on. Or he may be the peasant at the fete who comes on the stage, to swell the drinking chorus, and who, it may be observed, always turns his glass upside down before he begins to drink out of it. Or he may be the clown who takes away the doorstep of the house, where the evening party is going on. Or he may be the gentleman who issues out of the house on the false alarm, and is precipitated into the area. Or, to come to the actresses, she may be the fairy who resides forever in a revolving star with an occasional visit to a bower or a palace. Or the actor may be the armed head of the witch's cauldron. Or even that extraordinary witch, concerning whom I have observed in country places, that he is much less like the notion formed from the description of Hopkins than the Malcolm or Denalbane of the previous scenes. This society, in short, says, be you what you may, be you actor or actress, be your path in your profession never so high, or never so low, never so haughty, or never so humble, we offer you the means of doing good to yourselves, and of doing good to your brethren. This society is essentially a provident institution, appealing to a class of men, to take care of their own interests, and giving a continuous security only in return for a continuous sacrifice and effort. The actor by the means of this society obtains his own right to no man's wrong, and when, in old age, or in disastrous times, he makes his claim on the institution, he is enabled to say, I am neither a beggar, nor a suppliant. I am but reaping what I sowed long ago. And therefore it is that I cannot hold out to you that in assisting this fund you are doing an act of charity in the common acceptation of that phrase. Of all the abuses of that much abused term, none have more raised my indignation than what I have heard in this room in past times, in reference to this institution. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.